Good afternoon. Welcome on in to Kildare Focus. It's Monday, the 20th of March. You're listening to KFM. It's Caoimhe Hearney with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Aidan Farrelly. He's a PhD student in social sciences, specialising in youth work at Maynooth University. He'll be giving advice on how to change your approach to parenting when your child becomes an adolescent. And then we'll speak to Dr. Bobby Smith, Clinical Senior Lecturer in Addiction Studies at the Department of Public Health and Primary Care at Trinity College. A new UN report says Irish people are the joint fourth highest consumers of cocaine in the world. And then we'll speak to Paul Gilligan, CEO of St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. More than one in five people have experienced discrimination at work due to mental health difficulties. And then we'll speak to Tom Coleman, health scientist and sleep coach. He'll be telling us why you should stop hitting the snooze button in the morning. I think many of us will be guilty of that one. Of course, if you want to get in touch with the show about any of the issues that we're going to raise, it's 045 898 999. If you want to email me, it's studio@kfmradio.com, or of course you can send me a text or WhatsApp.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, parents tend to be quite conscious of practices when the children require maximum physical intervention when it comes to food and hygiene and general health and safety. So what happens when we witness children or our children evolve from childhood through adolescence? Well, I'm joined on the line by Aidan Farrelly. He's a PhD student in social sciences and he is specialising in youth work at Maynooth University. Good afternoon, Aidan.
Hi, Caoimhe. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you on. I think it's something that many parents will probably resonate with, Aidan. You know, you kind of know all the things to do up to a certain stage and then you hit puberty and the child is essentially like a mini adult. They think they are, but they're obviously not.
And it's that negotiation that's consistent throughout that time, which is quite fractious at times. It can be tough. And the task of being a parent to a teenager is almost, it evolves from being a very physical task of changing nappies and all this pushing buggies to actually, it can be quite more emotional when it comes to having conversations and trying to challenge. And I suppose the where the article came from initially, Caoimhe, I've been a youth worker for about 15 years now. And I tell people it really is the best job in the world. But the similarities between the profession of youth work and that idea of parenting young people really boils down to the relationship that we have with teenagers and how that relationship can be used then to challenge young people's beliefs, but also to I suppose, loosen up a little bit in terms of that decision-making, because it is that tension between what kind of young people aren't necessarily adults yet, but they're no longer children either. They're in this kind of process of transition from one to the other that's individual to every young person, but it's also very much dependent on the approach the parent takes to that as well.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you say loosen up, Aidan, because it's something like, and I'm just speaking from my own experience, like I'm 30 now, but sometimes you see the parents who don't let their children do anything, won't let them out, won't let them go to the teen disco. They're sometimes, like, and again, this is from my own experience in school, they're sometimes the children that are hopping out the bedroom windows at night, going off with lads down the road in cars at 16, because they don't have any freedom. They feel the need to go behind parents' backs.
And I think that tends to come from certainly from my experience, it tends to come from the right place. It's a tough time to be a teenager in Ireland right now. But I think the fact of the matter is that it's always been, and it always probably will be, a challenging time to be a teenager in society, because it's not necessarily set up to be very supportive. So usually when we make those decisions as parents to maybe prevent young people from doing something that we may see as risky or dangerous or precarious behaviour, we're doing that from a place of, let's just keep that young person safe, or let's just prevent or minimise the risk. But actually, quite often, what's the most learned for that young person and for the family in general is, let's go experience it, let's be informed by the experience. And then so important in terms of that relationship after, Caoimhe, is let's talk it through afterwards. How did it go? What did we learn? What might change for the next time? And that, it's like you say, it's the discos, it's all these experiences, especially as youth workers. We've been working with young people over the last year who've really come through a very difficult two-year period where those discos were gone, or those kind of experiences outside of school were really minimised, and the impact that that's had on young people's personal and social development has yet to be truly, I think, researched and finalised, but we know it certainly had an impact. And while we can't completely let the reins go where we don't know where our young people are, it's about that informed piece where I always know where they are, I know what they're doing, but I'm not in complete control either, but I'm certainly going to be around after the fact to see how did it go, how did you feel, and maybe what to do the next time around.
Yeah, 100%. I think many, you know, children and I suppose, yeah, the adolescence of the world suffered the most, because that's the time where you're supposed to be going out, meeting friends, meeting people, mingling, and then all of a sudden it was stay at home and don't go anywhere, Aidan. In terms of then, right, the pressure that parents are under, you know, you have little Bobby, let's say, and Bobby wants to go off to a disco that all of his friends are going to. Bobby's parents are saying, no, it's not safe, it's not this, it's not that. And yet, maybe his group of six or seven friends are going. Like, in that situation, like, what do you do? Because you're kind of under this pressure that really, should my child be going? But maybe you think that it's not safe for them to go.
It's so hard. It's so difficult. I've got a teenager in this house, and I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, I always remember my ma saying, there's no book that's written to help parents with teenagers. Well, now there are, but equally so, they're not always relevant to specific situations either. For me and for our approach, it can differ for others. But to us, how often do we reflect as parents and say, why am I taking the stance of no? Why am I taking the stance of I don't want Bobby to go to that disco? What is it in me that is worried about this situation? And then can we mitigate that worry and weigh it up versus the potential benefits for Bobby to go, to have that experience, to himself go and be nervous and be excited and get to be with his friends outside of that school environment. But as I always say, then when Bobby comes back at 11 o'clock, half 11 on the Friday night after the disco, that's when the parenting kicks in again. Then you're sitting down, you're having a cup of tea. Well, tell me all about it. How did it go? Who did you see? What did you do? And that's why there's learning for all of us. And I think that's as much attention that we give to young people going through that process of childhood to adulthood, and we have this perception that they will reach that destination of adulthood. That process, equally, we're changing from parents of children to parents of teenagers, and it's a completely different ballgame. And I think while there's no book, there's no Bible, what there always can be is that relationship. And if that's the starting point, just like in any youth work process, you can't go too far wrong. Because once the relationship is strong and the communication lines are really clear, then everything else can be navigated. You know, we can have the talks, we can have the arguments, we can disagree with each other. And sometimes that compromise and that power dynamic is really important. Sometimes young people need to feel that power and to be empowered to make those decisions for themselves. Okay, Bobby, you're going to go to this disco. This is what's going to happen potentially. These are some of the perks. This is some of the good side. But also there's a risk of this. Do you still want to make that decision? Okay, and we'll be here for you after the fact.
So maybe a compromise then, you know, well, you can go, but we're going to collect you at the gate at this time. We're going to drop you off. You know, I suppose that kind of thing, Aidan, where, you know, you can come to some kind of mutual understanding.
I've lost count, Cleve, of the amount of times I've sat outside discos waiting on my eldest to come out. And again, it's that thing we kind of take it in turns. And is there a network of parents? Is there, you know, if there's three or four young people going together, well, why not have a little text between the parents groups to say, well, look, we'll drop, we'll collect. Maybe one of us will be there for just in case the worst case scenario does happen, that there's somebody there. That's quite common now. Compromise is crucial. But compromise isn't straightforward. And how do we get to that place of compromise? Because usually my starting point is quite black and white. Okay. But equally, probably so is Bobby's at 15 years of age. He's probably black and white in what he's going to go and do as well. So again, how do we navigate that? It's not overnight, Cuiva. It's not in a day or two. It takes time. And that's the joy of it. That's the beauty of that relationship, is we have the time. Yeah. Time is something we can always afford to find a bit more of when it comes to just nurturing that relationship.
The funny thing is as well, Aidan, is that, you know, there's no real blueprint for it because every child is different. Like some children are much more spirited than others. Some are going to give more pushback. Some might have been a model child up until 12 and then all of a sudden, you know, it's all hell breaks loose. But what I think is interesting as well is parents, I think, seem to kind of nearly change as children, as they get older, as they, you know, the way you parent your first child nearly seems to be wildly different than you parent your last child. Speaking from experience, being the eldest, I would notice like the leniency really much more on the younger siblings in my family and even on in my wider family. And that can be quite hard to deal with in a friendship group as well, where maybe your child is the eldest and the rest of the kids in the group are the youngest children. Parents seem to be a little bit more relaxed in their roles at that stage, don't they?
Because I suppose if we're speaking from that place where parents make these decisions from the best place, but, you know, concerned about safety or concerned about risk, if you're the eldest, you've probably proven that the risk is somewhat less than maybe what they first thought, or, you know, the safety issues wouldn't be as big of an issue. So over time, we learn based on what we see as evidence, as fact. So when you're the eldest or when it's the first time you're experiencing something as a young person or as a parent, we tend to really, I suppose, batten down the hatches and be, you know, quite conservative in our decision making. And no one can really be challenged about that. That's not easy. But again, there is that informed risk. And that's a really interesting, I think, process of thought where both nearly young person and the parent need to take a little bit of leap of faith. It mightn't always go to plan A. Usually, just like in youth work, there's plan B, C, D and E. But again, that's the beauty of it. It's about making sure we listen to each other and those concerns, and we hash those out in advance. And then after the fact, whatever the issue may be, how do we debrief that together? How do we learn together about that? And that's where, I suppose, coming back to that analogy of it's a very physical task being a parent of a toddler or a young child. It's maybe much more an emotional task when we're talking about 15, 16-year-olds, where the time is necessary to talk to each other, to listen to each other and to kind of bat those issues out. That's where the learning comes. And that's, like you say, where we see the risk is actually not as much, or we're making probably more informed decisions as parents as well. Mm. It's not easy. It's not straightforward.
What's interesting is that you say here, it's people shouldn't say, and I think it's something every parent, I would say, does. Back in my day, and you say you shouldn't refer to that because it's not really relevant and the argument doesn't necessarily work, Aidan.
No, and I grew up watching Kevin and Perry. I don't know if your listeners will be aware of Kevin and Perry, but it's probably an old comedy show, and there's a film about it. But the mantra coming from the teenagers in that show is, it's so unfair. You just don't understand. You don't get it. You don't get me. And while we might be coming from the right place saying, well, I was fine. So back when I was a teenager, this wasn't an issue. But I think there's enough research that tells us we tend to look back on our time as teenagers in either a rose-tinted way and saying it was all grand back then, or we might focus on the one or two really big issues that we remember that were scary or didn't pan out very, very well. And they also equally might guide how we parent. But the transition is the same. But like you say, being a teenager now is still quite considerably different than what it is or what it was 10, 20, 30 years ago. It generationally changes. And so it's about making sure, again, and I'm sorry for repeating myself, but it's just so important. If we give of our opinion like that and we try to teach all the time without truly listening first, young people feel like they're not heard, and they feel like that's when our parents won't understand, because they're not listening. They don't hear the reality for me, which they're probably themselves making an assumption that it was so different. I mean, I don't feel like it's a lifetime ago that I was a teenager, but it's still 20 years ago. Mm. And there were issues, there were concerns. They're different to now, but there's also quite similarities as well. We want really ultimately to encourage our young people to make as informed a decision as they can. And that comes by ensuring that the young people are open and ready to listen to that. And that comes from the relationship.
Open lines of communication there as well. And I suppose as well then, Aidan, not to kind of have, you know, What, like, when I sometimes you see parents and they ask, you know, when children come and say, oh, can I sleep over in this house? No, you can't. Why? Because I said so. And I think a lot of children, I remember that in my day now, no offense to my parents, but that really used to bug me because I'd be like, well, just give me a reason. Like, you have to tell me why I can't go, you know?
I used to ask the same, I've had the same conversations with my parents, and when I'd say to my dad why, he'd just reply, that's the why.
That's same the why. As my father.
I want more than that. I deserve more than that. And that's the thing. When we don't have the information, then we see red and we get really angry. And then that's kind of what I talked about in the article a little bit. That's where the friction can come in a relationship, when we're not being upfront with each other, really.
Yeah.
And so, but that's not to say either that if a teenager or a young person wants a sleepover, as your example is, on a Friday night, if they ask for that Friday morning, it just mightn't work. But if you spell out the logistics of, listen, it's not going to work tonight, but maybe we can look at it for next Friday, or we can talk it through, that's where it can kind of tend to have a more constructive outcome. Whereas if it's just no, and I'm not going to give you the rationale for that no, well, then it's back to the idea, how useful is our mutual relationship here? Because if I'm not going to give you the full ins and outs of that decision, then as a young person, you're probably more inclined to pull back yourself. You're not going to give as much if you're not getting as much. Remember, these young people are smart, they're creative, they're ambitious, they're energetic. They're just young people in Ireland are the most amazing. And we've got youth services in this county that do phenomenal work. So we should never underestimate their capacity to see through that and go, well, I deserve more than no. Give me the rationale.
Yeah, Aidan, I know you said you have a teenager in your own house. I don't have any children, so I'm sure people are listening in thinking, well, we'll see how good she does now when she has her own. And usually that's the way everyone thinks that they can do better. But to be continued, I suppose, Aidan Farrelly, PhD student in social sciences, specialising in youth work at Maynooth University. Thanks very much, Aidan.
Thanks, Fiva.
Now, if you want to be part of one of the world's happiest countries, then you might want to move to Finland, because Finland once again has topped the World Happiness Report, which was released this morning and measures social support, income, health, freedom, generosity and the absence of corruption to determine a country's national happiness. So Finland tops the list for the sixth year in a row, followed by Denmark, Iceland, Israel, the Netherlands, Sweden, Norway, Switzerland, Luxembourg and New Zealand. So that's the top 10. And no surprise there that, of course, the Nordic countries all included in the top 10. And according to the report, most populations around the world continue to be remarkably resilient despite several crises such as the COVID-19 pandemic, global energy crisis, high inflation and the war in Ukraine. And then more generally, it says people are happier living in countries where the happiness gap is smaller. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Ireland ranks 14th place, so not in the top 10, behind Austria, Australia and Canada, but just ahead of the United States, Germany and Belgium. And Lithuania is the only new country in the top 20, but war-torn Afghanistan and Lebanon remain the two unhappiest countries in the survey. The first World Happiness Report from the Sustainable Development Solutions Network, which is a United Nations global initiative, was published back in 2012. So there again, Finland topping the polls for the sixth year in a row. And interestingly enough, the Nordic countries there that are all included, as we know, most of them have very, very high tax brackets. Many of the people in those countries are paying up on and above in 40 to 50% in tax. But you see, they have, you know, their health system is brilliant, their childcare is brilliant. You know, in some of these countries, you're talking about only paying, you know, maybe 30-40 quid per month for childcare, because everything is actually subsidised. So, you know, it's only something we can dream of, but hopefully we'll be able to take a few tips from them. And going forward, we might get into the top 10. Coming up after the break, we'll speak to Dr. Bobby Smith, Clinical Senior Lecturer in Addiction Studies at the Department of Health and Primary Care, Trinity College. There's a new UN report which says people in Ireland are joint fourth highest consumers of cocaine in the world. Don't go away.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, Irish people are the joint fourth highest consumers of cocaine globally. That's relatively speaking, according to a new United Nations report. And I'm joined now on the line by Dr. Bobby Smith. He's a clinical senior lecturer in addiction studies at the Department of Public Health and Primary Care at Trinity College. Good afternoon, Dr. Smith.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Quite worrying, I suppose, the findings of this new report, Dr. Smith.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised myself, to be honest with you, in terms of where we came in the list of ranking. I mean, it's not news to me that there's an issue around cocaine use in Ireland. It's certainly one that's grown over the last number of years. I was a little bit surprised to see that we came so high in the rankings. I think the figure is about sort of 2%, a bit over 2% of adults say they've used cocaine at some stage in the last year, and that's the statistic they focused in on.
Yeah, so if you look at that then on a, you know, more just people scale, it's 1 in 40, which really means that you're never in a pub where that kind of thing isn't going on then, Dr. Smith.
Yeah, I think that's increasingly the case. I think you're dead right to mention pubs because clinically and socially, I guess the correlation that we notice with cocaine is that it's very closely related to drinking. In any setting where there's people getting drunk and drinking a lot, there will be cocaine use. And you know, when we look at sort of people's journey into cocaine use, we find that the vast majority of people were drinking at the time of their first cocaine use, and that's whether they're adolescents or adults.
Okay. There might be a perception out there among some people that, you know, it's becoming more acceptable and that some people are able to do it recreationally and they're fine and it can be done, like you said, like people take it in the pub or do it at weekends and they think it's fine. What would you think about that, Dr. Smith?
I suppose the truth is, not everyone who uses any particular drug, whether it's heroin, cocaine, cannabis or anything, gets addicted to it. So some people do get away with it, but obviously some don't. So what we've seen in our addiction treatment services is an escalation in demand for treatment from people who've lost control of their relationship with cocaine and run into problems with it. They're seeking addiction treatment in larger numbers. If you also look at the hospital data, we see cocaine-related hospital admissions have increased substantially in the last 10 years because it's a drug that has significant effects on the cardiac system. It pushes up your blood pressure and your heart rate an awful lot, and particularly for older people who take it, that can cause major health problems for them. And it is a bit of a feature of it, maybe in comparison to drugs like ecstasy or cannabis, that it seems to be slightly older adults who use it. It's an expensive drug, so it sort of peak rates of use occur more around people around the sort of 30-year-old age mark. It's not teenagers so much. It's not 20-year-olds. It's people who've got money in their pockets in their late 20s, early 30s.
Okay.
Would be most inclined to use it.
The purity of cocaine at a retail level then, they found, has also increased dramatically. So back in 2009, cocaine in Europe was 35% pure, and now it's averaging at more than 60% pure, according to the report. Does that mean that the cocaine is stronger and more harmful, or does it mean the opposite?
I guess it does mean it's stronger, so that would mean that people could maybe reduce their use to get the same effect in terms of the quantity of powder they're snorting. But I suppose ultimately at the end of the day, anything that people are using a stronger substance, that's bad news from an addiction perspective, it's bad news from a health perspective. The increase or the relatively high rates of use in Ireland and the increasing purity, that may relate to the fact that, I mean, across Europe, a lot of the major, the organised crime groups, they exist in every country, but it does seem to be a number of Irish gangs have got a particular amount of reach, and I suppose maybe a side effect of their success across Europe may mean that, you know, there's actually more access and availability here in Ireland, which is, I suppose, their home base.
And it's I only said this to the guys in work here in the last few weeks, like there seems to be so many drug seizures all the time, and yet we're always hearing from different youth services and drug services and rehabilitation that the demand and the accessibility of it is still as easy as ever, Dr. Smith?
Yes, that's certainly a worry. It's hard to really understand the shift in societal attitude. I think there's always been people who use cocaine, but there seems to be a degree of shame and embarrassment associated with it. People would rather conceal it from the wider peer group. But there now seems to be a willingness just to use cocaine in front of anyone and everyone. So that sort of, that increasing tolerance that maybe we all have towards other people's drug use and then matched with sort of, you know, an increase in casualness amongst those who are actually using these drugs to do so in public is a real shift.
I have actually a text in here to 0833979797. This woman says she doesn't want to be named, but she says her husband started a new job last year. He was shocked to find that in his mid-40s, all of his work colleagues on their work nights out were using cocaine. Something you probably hear quite often, Dr. Smith.
Yeah, it's certainly increasingly common, you know, and I suppose what I would hear about is, say, young people who run into addiction issues with it as well, that they, maybe they're working in settings where they're certainly getting a lot of money all of a sudden, and it almost seems to me like there's dealers then target settings like that where there's large numbers of males working, and, you know, use can become rapidly normalised, and people feel like they've got a lot of cash and they can afford this initially, but then they quickly discover that they've used way more than they can afford, and they end up in debt.
Okay. How serious is cocaine use, as in, like, for your health? Is it very easy to overdose from in comparison to other drugs, or what way does it work, Dr. Smith?
I suppose its main effects are on the heart and the cardiovascular system, and certainly if you take enough of any substance, you can overdose, and it's featuring in an increasing number of overdoses. But it wouldn't maybe carry the same overdose potential as a drug like heroin, which can just, you know, quickly turn off your ability to breathe. So the overdose risk is significant, but maybe not the absolute worst. But people do underestimate those risks. And again, what I've been just struck by is, and that texter sort of makes that point as well, you know, it's people in their 30s and 40s using this drug, that's maybe the big surprise. And, you know, some of those, as you get a little bit older, you're more vulnerable to those adverse health effects in a way you mightn't be as a 20-year-old. And that's resulted certainly in a significant escalation in hospitalizations.
Okay, that is Dr. Bobby Smith, Clinical Senior Lecturer in Addiction Studies at the Department of Public Health and Primary Care at Trinity College, with that findings of the new report that 1 in 40 people in Ireland have used cocaine in the past year. Thanks very much, Dr. Smith. Now, moving on to something similar enough, but slightly different, because we're moving to St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. More than 1 in 5 people have experienced discrimination at work due to mental health difficulties. And I'm joined on the line by Paul Gilligan. He's CEO at St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Cuiva.
Paul, mental health, it can be sometimes a taboo topic. But in terms of a workplace, I can only imagine that it must be heightened in that area.
Yeah, I mean, I think an awful lot of positivity has come over the last 5 or 6 years regarding mental health and people with mental health difficulties. I think there's much more awareness everywhere, including in the workplace. I think where we fall down and where we really need to, I suppose, improve a bit is around our understanding and the information we have about mental health, about people with mental health difficulties and what that actually means. And that's, I think, particularly relevant to the workplace, where I think there's a lot of time people make the assumption that if a person has a mental health issue, or they say they have a mental health issue, that in some way that's going to necessarily affect how they do their job, might affect how your employer sees you. An employee might think that it's going to affect how they're seen in the workplace, even though that might not be the case. So I think there's a fair bit of work to be done. And so we've really tried to focus on that in this new phase of our No Stigma campaign. We've tried to, I suppose, look to explore how to support people with mental health difficulties in the workplace specifically, and to highlight the rights of employees and also the role of employers. So it's a part of a bigger campaign we have called No Stigma, which really focuses on what it's like to not experience stigma when you have a mental health issue and how that in itself can help you move forward with your recovery and help you live a fulfilling life.
Okay. And I know, like, you know, you've launched this campaign back in 2020 and it's hashtag No Stigma. But I suppose, like, on the ground, if we look, Paul, at people within the workplace, I'm sure a lot of people would be very, very hesitant to go and tell their boss, listen, I suffer from, you know, any kind of mental health issue. There would be that fear that perhaps you might be passed up for a promotion. Perhaps there might be a view that, you know, you're not up to scratch in terms of work the way that maybe some other employee would be as well, Paul.
Yeah, and that's the sort of stuff that has to be challenged. It's got to be challenged at all levels. So first and foremost, an employee, a person in a workplace has to have confidence in what the employer, what the job will do if you disclose that you have a mental health issue. On the other side, an employer needs to think about what do we do to support people with mental health issues. It's not just about how we respond, it's how we support people. And I think if you can switch the focus to support, it makes people feeling discriminated against or feeling a stigma much less. And, you know, 22% of people say that they've experienced discrimination at work, 22% of people experiencing a mental health difficulty.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, things have changed also to the positive. So, you know, we see more and more people, so 66% of people believe that a person, for example, who experiences panic attacks could still work as the head of a large company. 43% of people have had positive experiences of disclosing mental health difficulties at work. So this is really a journey, and I think it's more important to focus on the positive. An awful lot of employers have really started to take wellness very seriously, introducing spate of wellness programs. The next step is really to look at what do we do to support people with mental health difficulties to not just disclose, but also to be able to maybe take time out, maybe then come back to their job and make sure that they're not discriminated against when they're looking for promotions. You know, work plays such an important part in our mental health.
Absolutely.
The World Health Organization has identified that. Lots of organizations have identified that. So if we can crack that, then we'll do people a real service in terms of their mental health and their wellness.
Yeah, and I've read a lot of things recently, Paul, about, you know, the workplaces and wellness, and there are people who say in a majority of workplaces there's a, you know, there's a kind of a tick the box wellness, but a lot of employees don't feel like really their boss or their management are caring about the wellness. It's more done because, oh, we have a wellness program, but really, in terms of the actual accommodations in the workplace, they didn't feel like they were there. And what's interesting, according to a survey from St. Patrick's Mental Health Services last year, it revealed that 55% of people are not aware that people with mental health difficulties have the right to reasonable accommodations in the workplace. Could you list for us, Paul, what reasonable accommodations would look like?
Well, I think the first thing is being able to talk about your mental health in the workplace. That's the first thing. The second thing is being able to take time out to resolve some of the issues if you need that. It might be about changing your work patterns. It might be about being able to look at how you do your job. And all of those things, it's also about being able to be confident that you're continuing to be given the same job that you were always given when you disclose that you have a mental health difficulty. It also means that it's not utilised against you, so to speak, if you're seeking a promotion. All of these are good practice. We know all of this stuff. Really, we're on a journey. And one of the things, you've made a very good point, and that is we need to integrate wellness and acceptance and understanding of mental health into the very fabric of every organisation. You're right. You know, it's like every transition. Sometimes it starts with, we'll tick a box, then it moves to, we better do this stuff because it looks good sort of thing, and we're expected to do it. But it's really about ownership. Remember, a company will benefit from this. Employees will be happier. It'll be easier to get people to work and be loyal to the company. and it will become more productive. It's a win-win for everybody, and from a personal point of view, it will enhance a person's mental health and their wellness if it's a good, mentally healthy environment. So it's about really integrating that belief system into the company and applying all those good principles and keeping in mind that people with that experience mental health difficulties, their rights should be protected, and it will actually benefit the company as well.
Okay, that is Paul Gilligan, CEO of St. Patrick's Mental Health Services, with that news that more than one in five people have experienced discrimination at work due to mental health difficulties. Thanks very much, Paul.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney.
Now, my next guest is going to tell us why we should not be hitting the snooze button in the morning on our alarm clock. And I'm joined now on the line by Tom Coleman. He's a health scientist and sleep coach. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon.
Tom, I'd say this is probably something that most people do. I know I probably hit the button about four or five times in the morning.
It's almost a gauge of how well you're doing, how much more sleep you might require, right? So I encourage people to set what I call a reverse snooze button. I feel like that people are at near full capacity in their life. They're struggling to get to bed on time. They're nowhere near their full potential. And your sleep really is kind of a barometer of how well you're dealing with life and stress. And it seems to be a big issue for people. And then the morning arrives, the alarm goes off, and we just haven't had enough sleep, so we continue to hit this snooze button.
Tom, I always wake up, like I'll wake up, no problem, like before my alarm. But I don't wake, I wake up before my alarm and I look at the phone and I think, oh, grand, I don't have to get up yet. Then I go back to sleep and then I hit the snooze button. But that's probably not the best way to go about things, is it?
Well, planning, I mean, generally speaking, we tend to wake at the same time every morning. So the thing to get right is the bedtime. Now, if we sleep in cycles, we do sleep in cycles of 90 minutes. So if you need 6 hours or 7.5 hours, that would be 4 cycles or 5 cycles, plan it correctly. And so get to bed at the correct time. Leave time for a wind down. Get off the scrolling at night time as well, because people tend to do that a lot. They have a racing mind and they distract their minds with social media. And get that routine right, and then you should be getting sufficient sleep. And fine, one go on the snooze button or whatever, but it's the people who kind of hit it again and again and just feel like they haven't rested.
I think on my part, it's probably laziness now more than anything. Tom, in terms of like sleep and how much sleep we should be getting, because different people say different things, how many hours of sleep should we get? And are people different?
People are different. We even inherit what are known as clock genes. So there are about 9 different genes that may determine things like your chronotype, which is, are you a night owl? Do you like staying up late? Or are you an early bird? Happy, chirpy, early in the morning? So a lot of things influence sleep. Then personal preference. Maybe you have children, maybe you don't. Maybe you have a very active life, so you train in the evening. All of these things feed in. So sleep is very personal. So you firstly decide on how much would be sufficient for me. How much do I need? And then from that, you kind of plan around that. You need to leave time for food and mental and cognitive wind down. Because we know the importance of wind down for children, but we don't do it for ourselves. There are many people who arrive in bed wired and tired and thinking, oh my God, what day is today? So I take out the bin. I have to do so much tomorrow. And then that disrupts their sleep. They're not deactivating.
Okay. A woman is after texting in here saying, my husband constantly falls asleep on the couch and then yet says he doesn't get a good night's sleep. Does napping affect your sleep?
Yes, because the mechanisms that push you to sleep, one of them is called sleep pressure. So the longer you're awake, the more tired you will be. And that's a real chemical called adenosine. Now, if you nap in the evening time, it's lowering the sleep pressure. And that's one of the mechanisms that will help push you to sleep. So look at the duration of the nap, because within a 90-minute sleep cycle, you're in light sleep for probably the first, up to about half an hour is when you transition into the much deeper stages. So maybe look at the nap times If you have to nap, maybe keep it shorter, 10 or 15 minutes to refresh. It won't take away too much of the sleep pressure either. So that's important to get right.
Okay, so daytime nap, maybe 10, 15 minutes, but you're saying an evening nap probably will affect your sleep going into the nighttime.
It will push back sleep onset, most likely.
Okay. Yeah. So it's interesting, yeah, that you say that there's clock genes and different things like that, because my brother, he literally, from the time he was a child, just always needed to go to bed at like 8 o'clock, and he's still like that now in his late 20s, and the rest of us would be real night owls, you know. I could go on no sleep. I could go out for a few nights and get up and I'd be fine. What do you do when you have a couple, one likes to go to bed real early and the other likes to go to bed at a later time, and they're sharing the same room? Is there any kind of mutual understanding they can come to there?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, there could be a bedroom divorce happening before a real one happens, right? So it just depends on the partner who goes to bed early. Are they being disrupted? Is their sleep being disrupted? To what degree by the partner coming into the bed? Maybe think about, for them, some really good earphones and everything else, or strategies that will cause the least amount of disruption. Because, you know, there are benefits to sleeping together. There's mixed science on what is best, you know. But I always think it comes down to the couple's preferences and lifestyle, and work comes into that, because some couples, maybe they're doing late shifts at work. So it always is kind of very personal. But the idea is that we try not to disrupt each other's sleep. And snoring is another big issue, of course, which, you know, is fairly well researched. And it's like boasting that you're getting a good sleep while your partner's like, they're being resentful, yeah. You know. So it's important.
Tom, I have another text in here from a guy, Johnny, and he says that my girlfriend will only sleep to the sound of ocean sounds, and she plays it for about an hour while we're trying to go asleep. Then she falls asleep and I can't sleep. When I turn it off, she immediately wakes up. Is this normal?
Yeah. Well, she's pre-programmed, preconditioned her brain to do that. And you entrain the systems. You entrain the systems to sleep, and you entrain sleep onset within yourself. Some people don't need to do that. So maybe there are other strategies that she could learn and teach. And I think that, you know, we get fixated on, well, this is the only way I can do it. But look, think about cognitive behavioral therapy. Think about other things that might help you. Because in some way, if she's waking when that goes off, her brain is associating. She's built an association there between that music and sound and sleep, whereas the actual association in the brain should be bed and sleep.
Okay, so probably better to wean off it, is it?
Yeah, you can train yourself. That's important to know, that there is that neuroplasticity there. You're able to retrain those systems to fall asleep.
Okay, so lastly, Tom, before I let you go, just back to the original question. Like, should we get up as soon as we, A, wake up, or B, from the first alarm?
I would say shortly after waking. What we don't want is to lie in bed looking and scrolling through social media for, you know, an hour and then drag ourselves out of bed. So I would say get up shortly after. The best way to clear the tiredness, the grogginess, is bright, natural sunlight. And in 10 years of working with people, I think I've yet to meet someone who says, well, the minute I wake up, I'm full of energy and revived. So that takes a little time, and the best way to do it is natural light.
Okay, that is Tom Coleman, health scientist and sleep coach, telling us why we should not be hitting the snooze button a few times in the morning. Of course, if you want to find Tom, he does have an Instagram page. And Tom, you do have a website as well, do you?
Yeah, www.tomcoleman.ie.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Thank you.